You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn and Tig Enright.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
Alessio Padolano from King's College London joins us today in the studio to set the day's agenda. Alessio, what do you have for us today?
Today we have a very interesting mix of news. We're going to be talking about drones flying over the Senkaku Islands, discussing how you might end up in prison if you spread rumours on the internet in China, and which one is the top number one Asian university.
Looking forward to that, Alessio. We'll also be finding out why the great and good of the business community are gathering in Dalian.
Plus, our culture editor Rob Bound sits down with the Man Booker Prize judge Natalie Haynes to run through the shortlist of this year's award.
The Lowland is a story which begins in Calcutta, and there are two brothers who are quite politically engaged. One of them goes away to Rhode Island to do his PhD, and one of them stays behind, and I really don't want to give away more of the plot, so you'll have to wait and see.
All that, plus we visit the happiest country in the world and review the Brazilian front pages. It's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Wednesday edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. President Obama has put his case for limited military strikes on Syria to the American people. In a televised address from the White House, the president said he'd ask Congress to postpone a vote on the issue while a Russian plan for Syria's chemical weapons to be placed under international control is explored. But he said doing nothing was not an option following last month's chemical weapons attack in Damascus, in which over 1,400 people are believed to have died.
If we fail to act, the Assad regime will see no reason to stop using chemical weapons. As the ban against these weapons erodes, other tyrants will have no reason to think twice about acquiring poison gas and using them. Over time, our troops would again face the prospect of chemical warfare on the battlefield, and it could be easier for terrorist organizations to obtain these weapons and to use them to attack civilians.
The White House says it stepped up security at U.S. facilities abroad on the anniversary of the 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. A year ago today, Islamist extremists attacked the U.S. compound in Benghazi, killing the ambassador to Libya and three other Americans. In a statement, the White House said the president's national security team is taking measures to prevent 9/11-related attacks and to ensure the protection of U.S. persons and facilities abroad. Pakistan says it hopes the release of a leading figure in Afghanistan's Taliban will boost the country's peace process. Officials say Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar is likely to be free within weeks. It's 3 years since he was captured, accused of orchestrating attacks on NATO forces in Afghanistan.
President Karzai wanted him to be given to Afghanistan, but we feel that if they have to play a role, positive role in the reconciliation process, then they must do it according to what their own shura, their own leadership wants them to do.
That was Sartaj Aziz, who's Pakistan's foreign policy chief. Officials in Seoul say North and South Korea have agreed that the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Park will reopen next week. The South's unification ministry says all-night talks ended with agreement that Kaesong will resume operations next Monday. It will also be hosting a roadshow for foreign investors in October. It was closed in April when tension on the Korean peninsula was high after Pyongyang issued a series of threats against its neighbour. Kaesong, which is situated in North Korea, is home to 123 South Korean factories employing more than 50,000 North Koreans. The new president of the International Olympic Committee says the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi are his first priority. Germany's Thomas Bach comfortably won the vote to appoint Jacques Rogge's successor and become the ninth president in the IOC's 119-year history. He says he's sure Sochi will put on a great Winter Games, and he outlined his main objectives for the Olympic movement.
We should develop a project of sustainability and feasibility for the Olympic Games. We have to take care of the credibility and integrity of the sport organization and the sports competition. We have to give, in the framework of a good governance, the IOC members more possibilities to take part in the decision-making of the IOC, and we have to address the youth in a way that leads them to practicing sports.
Residents of a village in the county of Berkshire in southeast England have been left perplexed by the mysterious appearance of a red postbox in the middle of a bridge crossing the River Thames. The box is fixed to the buttress of the bridge at Sunning-on-Thames, making it only accessible to those on riverboats. There are a number of theories for the box's sudden appearance. Most local people suspect it may be the work of a local artist or a PR stunt for a nearby theatre company. Presumably they're putting on Postman Pat or the postman always rings twice. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney Burnham, thank you very much for that. 5 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. Alessio Padalano, Professor of War Studies at King's College London, joins us today in the studio. Welcome to the program. Alessio, we're going to be focusing our attention on Asia, but where should we begin specifically this morning?
I was thinking to start off with news from the Asahi Shimbun. Last night it was confirmed that what had been spotted and what was believed to be a drone flying over the East China Sea was indeed a drone, and the Chinese officials confirmed that they had such an asset flying for duty training over the waters of the East China Sea.
So it was an unmanned drone, I believe the Japanese fighter aircraft that went to intercept it noted that there was no cockpit. What kind of an aircraft are we talking about here? I mean, this is a spying exercise, really, but ironically on islands where there's nothing actually happening.
That's true. I mean, I suppose that the best way to put this into context is just by thinking about what's been happening off the Somali coast and the eastern part of Africa, where drones have been used extensively for monitoring activities at sea. So in this respect, it is perfectly natural that in a situation where a lot more is happening and has been happening, this would have come about. The Japanese themselves have been talking about introducing drones for their routine maritime patrol activities. So in all, you can take it both ways, in a way that, from my point of view, it seems like interesting and certainly a positive development that in order to increase the awareness on the ground, the different sides are talking about introducing what is the latest kid on the street to do this type of duty.
But China's drone program is something that definitely will worry Japan and its allies, specifically the Americans, really. Earlier this year, we saw China test its first stealth drone, it becoming just the third country in the world to have this kind of technology. How worried should the West and its allies be about Japan's increasing drone capability?
Earlier on, earlier on this year, we learned that the Chinese were using drones particularly for internal security, monitoring, for example, drug dealing activities and things of this kind. So it was pretty much foreseeable. It was just something, one of those things that you know it's coming about at some point down the line. So this is confirming something that has been rumoured and talked about for a while. How much of a game changer? Well, definitely, I think one can put a positive spin, as I said, to this story in terms of improving the overall surveillance and monitoring of the activities. But definitely is also a question that raises questions about how far this will go, particularly in terms of the sort of weaponized version of drones, you know, those that carry actually bombs and go around.
When you consider where the aircraft went over the disputed Senkaku Islands, I mean, how much of this was really just about China showing off to its neighbours about the kit they have and that the Japanese don't?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that the Ministry of Defense confirmed that it didn't go into Japanese airspace. So it was around the air, but it didn't go over, because that would have been an entirely different
story.
But in
that direction.
But it is in that direction, certainly. Or at least it raises the question for the Japanese on how we deal with this. And there was kind of a honest recognition at some point by the Ministry of Defense saying, well, we're probably a little bit of a step behind in this respect. As I say, this is something that proves that there is a direction. How much of a new sense, of a new addition? This is just sort of upgrading what you've already been doing and putting into sort of a different context.
And this also ties in with Japan and China's growing force when it comes to the sea. China launching its very own aircraft carrier. Japan launching, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, its largest battleship since World War II. This is perhaps a very dangerous sort of arms race when it comes to naval technology and naval equipment.
Definitely the maritime realm is bound to remain the key place and the key space where the geopolitics of the region in terms of distribution of power are going to be reshaped. So it is only logical that in that particular realm, technology that is used to enhance your ability to control it if necessary are going to be seen. So a lot more to come, and definitely this is another step that complements what we've seen for the past few months.
Moving on to another story you've chosen from the South China Morning Post, and it talks about 3-year jail sentences for people who spread rumours on the internet. And it's quite interesting, you look at it in a bit more detail, and it seems to have set out the criteria, the bar you have to pass before you can be convicted of this.
Absolutely. Now, you know, this is a fascinating story, and in a way it's a story that it is about the internet, because it is one of these new frontiers of social interaction. So from this point of view, it is a fascinating, unexplored terrain. So we're charting new waters here, kind of tying it with what we were just talking about. But the contradiction there, there's this tension. Xi Jinping launched this policy of cracking down on corruption, trying to put the whole of Chinese society back on track into what was later defined as the China Dream. But interestingly enough, in order to do that, you have to preserve a degree of social stability, which in turn is bringing about all this sort of question about, so how do we deal with the internet, which is one of those places where we need to regulate society in order to keep it stable.
And this is part of an increasing crackdown by Xi Jinping and his government. And particularly, they're targeting really the high... verified people on Chinese microblogging sites like Weibo, which has really become a political forum as of late.
Absolutely. And I think that's exactly the element of this tension. On the one hand, you've got a place like Weibo that is very difficult to control in a way, and you have to start fixing very precise rules. But at the same time, it has been sort of a guardian of this new politics in China, monitoring and talking about people who might be involved into illegal activities.
Well, you say how difficult it is to regulate Weibo. I mean, Weibo, for those who don't know, is the Chinese equivalent to Twitter. But I mean, the very fact that they have a Chinese equivalent and they're not using Twitter suggests that there are controls already on it and in place. And you look at this criteria they have to pass. A libelous post has to be forwarded more than 500 times or viewed more than 5,000 times for its author to be prosecuted under this new crime. I mean, like, it would make you worried to say anything lest it be retweeted or re-weiboed.
That's true. On the other hand, there is also an element of context. You know, like Chinese domestic law has an important component of circumstances. And so every single case has to be assessed in terms of the impact it had, what it actually led to at the end of the day. So this leaves some sort of an open door to the kind of balance that otherwise, as you say, it would be completely missing out.
And Alessia, let's finally move on to another story which you've highlighted for us. Many people in the last day or so talking about the latest world university rankings. I was very happy my university was number 17 on that list.
Get him.
Thank you. But it looks like a bit of a change at the top when it comes to Asia's top university.
Yes, there was a bit of a change. National University of Singapore, for the first time, overtook Hong Kong University into the lead. Now, the interesting thing about it is that when you actually look into the QS rankings and you have a closer look what is happening in Asia, and then you put Asia into a global context, you've got a bit of a mixed picture. You got a change at the top. You got the usual suspects still being there. You got University of Tokyo, University of Kyoto. You've got Peking University, Tsinghua. But at the end of the day, within the top 50 world universities, there were very few Asian universities. None of them was really those you would think about right on top of your head.
What's missing then?
Well, I suppose that still, you know, when you ask to your average sort of wealthy or, you know, sort of like this young generation of students from China or Japan or Korea or Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, where would you like to go and get your degree? Most likely they'll tell you, yeah, I'd like to go either America and UK. And I think that, in a way, is still part of
that component. That's one of the key kind of cultural factors in all of this, isn't it? Because it's a lot about prestige for these Asian students. And this is why, you know, it's really one of their goals to try to go to Harvard or Oxford or Yale or one of these big kind of name brand schools, which everyone really recognizes. You know, if you say to a student from Asia, for example, they go, I'm going to go to the National University of Singapore, it doesn't necessarily carry the same weight as saying I'm going to go to Yale.
No, absolutely. And, you know, let's throw kings in it as well, just because I like to blow my own horn. No, but the point being, we were actually in the top 20. And, you know, but no,
little plug there.
Yes. But no, the key point being that the you're absolutely right. The other question is also that when you look at the ranking of the top 400, altogether, it's not just that at the very top, you know, the major league universities. What is more problematic is that a large chunk of Chinese, Japanese, Korean, etc. universities, like the sort of the middle ground, is not there, which means that you might end up with some very top elites, highly educated, getting access either to your best universities or somewhere else, and the rest of the masses stands where?
Okay, Alessio Patilano from Top 20 University, King's College London. Thank you very much for coming in to talk
Thank
to
you.
Us.
Thank you.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be finding out what, if anything, will come out of the World Economic Forum Summer Davos in China.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here in London. It is 8:19. Sometimes when you see the business and economic world's movers and shakers wrapping up warm and heading to Davos for a chinwag, you know, you just hope it's really cold over there because, you know, all they're really doing is having a big old party.
Well, allow us to sicken you a little bit further by discussing Summer Davos. Yes, you heard it right. The sunny side of the World Economic Forum, which doesn't actually take place in Switzerland at all. Rather, this year, it's in Dalian in China. And if you wish you were there, well, David Schlesinger is. We're going to be talking to him in a little moment. He's managing director at Tripod Advisors and former editor-in-chief of Reuters. We're also joined in studio by Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both of you to the show. Let me start by asking you, Raffaello. This year's theme is meeting the innovation imperative. It sounds a bit waffly, really, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, far from it to me to undermine such, you know, August meetings, wonderful title. But I mean, you know, these meetings, they regularly have these very big grand titles that is sort of an overarching aim. It's usually a sort of big political banner. And then we see lots of leaders, be they business tycoons, be they national leaders. I've seen a number of European prime ministers going to this event, you know, gather together in a very nice location to talk about understanding how the world works and what they think it should be doing and how they think it should be going. And, you know, it's very easy in some ways to be quite cynical given the very nice locations they tend to choose for these events.
And it seems like this event in Dalian really doesn't have the same kind of stature, of course, as the one that we're all familiar with in Davos. But what I found quite interesting about this particular event is China's role in all of this, particularly when you look at the global leaders that are attending. Most of them are really from Central Asia. You have the leaders of Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan. Is this kind of a bit of a power play here from the Chinese to develop closer economic ties from Central Asian countries, for example?
Well, I think we're talking about Central Asian countries in particular. The real power play is Xi Jinping's visit, where he's actually still in Kyrgyzstan at the moment, having just passed through all the other three Central Asian states and signed some massive deals while he's there. I think that the Davos meeting, from a Chinese perspective, it's really, you know, China likes to see itself as a global player. I mean, you've got Premier Li Keqiang, who's the sort of number two in the system, coming to give a big speech there. He's the man sort of responsible for the economy within the system. I mean, you know, Xi Jinping is responsible for everything, but ultimately Li Keqiang tends to take the lead on economic things. He's given a very big speech at the head of this. He's sort of driving this forward. It's very much within China's vision of itself as seeing, you know, it is the country that, I mean, Dalian in particular has hosted this meeting three times. I heard that last year it was in Tianjin. So, you know, they're very keen on these sorts of events because it shows that they're part of the global discussion and in some ways leading it, you know.
I should explain that maybe David Schlesinger has been having a good old party of it because we're having trouble getting him on the line. So we're just going to keep on talking to Raffaello for the time being. But, you know, this it's a relatively new forum, the second Davos of the year. Why has it ended up in China? Why not Latin America? Why not North America? Why not have a World Economic Forum meeting in Africa where the greatest economic work needs to be done?
Well, I mean, I have to be honest and say that I'm not totally sure the mechanics of how these things are awarded. But one would suspect that countries probably bid for them. And I know the Chinese do enjoy, as I say, they enjoy hosting these big events. It's a platform for their leadership and them to talk about these sorts of issues. The issues we're talking about with technological innovation, I saw that another one of the banner headlines being used was the annual New Champions meeting. Well, China sees itself as a new champion, you know, and this is very much their way of showing that. And, you know, the additional benefit, of course, is that we've got all these business tycoons from around the world, big international multinationals, who the Chinese want to attract foreign investment from and want to attract business from. So this gives them a great opportunity to do that. So, you know, I think that why China in particular, it fits with their sort of global vision of themselves. I think the question as to why we're not doing it in, you know, I don't know, Timbuktu or something. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's practical reasons for that. But then, you know, I also wonder if they would, if Mali would have gotten around to bid for such a thing.
Do we know if any actual deals happen at these kind of conferences? Do any kind of concrete decision actually, are they actually made at these events? Or is it really just one big party, as we've been kind of implying?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very cynical perspective, but, you know, it's quite easy to be quite cynical about these things. But I think that they probably are meetings that take place at these things and maybe deals that emerge from it. From my knowledge or understanding of the WF forums, they don't necessarily have, you know, Chinese just had in Urumqi their big annual China-Eurasia Expo. At the end of that, they announce, you know, how many billions of dollars contracts that they signed. I don't think we get this out of the WFs as well. It's a slightly different sort of format.
Okay, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Thanks very much for coming into us to chew the fat over the fat chewers.
Thank you.
This week, The Entrepreneurs is celebrating its 100th episode by speaking to companies that have managed to keep business going for at least a century, from artisan candle makers to high-end designers.
But for this preview, we're in America. Founded in 1913, Shoot, New York City produces classic American outerwear. It's the brand that invented the Perfecto, a name they still own today, which is one of the most popular styles of leather jacket, the one with the asymmetrical zipper. Unfortunately, I don't have one. Do you, Ty?
No, funny. funnily enough. Yeah. Well, they work with many factories abroad, but Schott's New Jersey operation is where all the leather work takes place. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman went there to find out how the brand has stayed relevant for a century.
The town of Union is only a short train ride from New York City. It's an unassuming New Jersey suburb where locals will often start the conversation in Spanish. And for a little over a year, it's been home to Schott's 75,000 square foot factory, which employs around 100 workers. Schott NYC started in 1913 as a small operation in the basement of a tenement building in Manhattan's Lower East Side. The sons of Russian immigrants, Irving and Jack Schott manufactured fur-lined raincoats that they sold door-to-door until they made enough to open up a shop.
It is very much a New York City brand, even though you're here in our factory in New Jersey, about 15 miles outside of New York. The beginnings all came from New York. Not only the brand was born there, but my great-grandfather was also born in New York.
That's Jason Schott, chief operating officer and fourth-generation family member. Sat in his simple office a few doors down from the busy factory, he explains building the brand was at first a humble process. But things changed when his great-grandfather became the first designer to use a zipper on outerwear, creating the brand's iconic motorcycle jacket. Commonly referred to as the Perfecto, it was adopted by riders first because the asymmetrical zip kept out the wind. Then Marlon Brando wore it in The Wild One.
Hey, Johnny! Hey, get a load of this!
They're real belts! Aren't they cute?
Crazy!
Hey, somebody tell me what that means! BRMC! What does it mean?
Blank Rebels Motorcycle Club!
Isn't that cute? Hey, Johnny, what are you rebelling against?
What do you got?
By the 70s, the jacket was associated with some of music's biggest stars.
Everybody wanted to be the badass, to have that look, which really has been so relevant for 60 years. You know, it's still such an important look in fashion. And that was a big part of the growth as well. We do a lot. I mean, it's all facets of Americana, the police jackets, bomber flight jackets, pea coats and the motorcycle jackets, and other product categories in addition to jackets. But I think because of our association with the Perfecto, the asymmetrical motorcycle jacket, for so many years, yes, that's how we're best known. It seems to never go out of style. I mean, from Brando and James Dean to the Ramones and Bruce Springsteen in the 70s. Current rock stars and icons like Adam Levine and Jay-Z and Rihanna are all wearing that same jacket. It's just, we're very proud of it.
The motorcycle jacket consists of around 30 pieces of leather, each cut by hand one at a time. The classic model is made of cowhide, but some styles exist in lambskin, horsehide, or other versions of cow. John Francesco is one of the senior leather cutters in the factory. Armed with a small blade and a cardboard pattern, he skillfully slits the hide in pieces.
What's the jacket that you're working on right now?
This is a little motorcycle jacket.
And you do everything by hand?
Everything by hand. Everything by hand. One by one. Yes.
How long have you worked here for?
No, I don't want to know. You don't want to know, right? 43 years. I started in 1972. He wasn't even born that time.
After being cut, the leather travels to 5 different areas of the factory and is assembled at the end. About 30 different people will touch the jacket as it's being created. According to Jason, despite the constant growth of employees, not much has changed in the production process since the brand's beginnings. Some machines, for example, are a century old. Because of that, the company has a full-time mechanic on staff. It's a testament to the new generation's attachment to the brand's heritage.
Our focus has always been on the factory first. My family, my great-grandfather was always in the factory. My grandfather was always happiest tinkering with machines, and he in fact created a couple of proprietary machines. That was always his favorite part, was working on the actual machines. My mother is in the factory right now as we speak, inspecting every jacket that comes off the floor.
Jason's mother is the company's president, and his uncle is the CEO. He plans to hand down management to his children someday, but only when they're ready.
It's incredibly important to me to keep it a family business. I mean, it's my family was always the toughest bunch of employers I ever had, but they taught me a lot of valuable lessons. I have not always worked here. We always try to get any family members interested in joining to go get some experience working somewhere else to learn other areas of business and bring it into the company, and also to learn what it's like to work with for other people. And it gets a little bit challenging sometimes. We seem to do a good job as a family of separating business and family. So there are times where we don't always agree, and we'll have some heated days where we're battling back and forth on something. And it seems to be pretty easy. We transition pretty quickly from that to a family dinner where we're all together and none of that stuff comes up. So I think everybody has their own role. It's a big enough company that we each have our own area of expertise. And so it works out very well. And the best part is there's a trust factor with everyone.
That trust is one of the secrets to Schott's long-lasting success, he says. But the attachment to family and heritage influences much more than the company's strategy, as design director Charles Edmondson explains.
I'm going to show you in this last year's catalog a jacket that we did. We always base what we're doing next year on last year's success. That makes sense, right? This liner jacket here, which is nylon on the outside and Hudson Bay lining, and the inside did very well for us. So they want next year's version of that.
Jason's mother often says that history is the future, and that's a philosophy that really rings true for the brand. In a month, they will open the first Schott store in the country since the 1940s. Unsurprisingly, it's located less than a mile from the original shop, born nearly a century ago. For Monocle, in Union, New Jersey, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
And you can hear more from companies who have reached the ripe old age of 100 in this week's Century Special Edition of The Entrepreneurs that premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours if you happen to be in New Jersey.
Well, coming up in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be in the happiest country in the world, and we'll find out what it's like to judge the world's most famous literary prize. First, though, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Tig. President Obama has put his case for limited military strikes on Syria to the American people. In a TV address from the White House, he said he'd ask Congress to postpone a vote on the issue while a Russian plan for Syria's chemical weapons to be placed under international control is explored. And the White House says it stepped up security at US facilities abroad on the anniversary of the 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. A year ago today, Islamist extremists attacked the US compound in Benghazi, killing the ambassador to Libya and three other Americans. Pakistan says it hopes the release of a leading figure in Afghanistan's Taliban will boost the country's peace process. Officials say Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, who was captured 3 years ago, is likely to be free within weeks. Officials in Seoul say North and South Korea have agreed that the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Park will reopen next week. It'll also be hosting a roadshow for foreign investors in October. The new president of the International Olympic Committee, says the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi are his first priority. Germany's Thomas Bach comfortably won the vote to appoint Jacques Rogge's successor and become the ninth president in the IOC's 119-year history. And residents of a village in the county of Berkshire in southeast England have been left perplexed by the mysterious appearance of a red postbox in the middle of a bridge crossing the River Thames. It's fixed to the buttress of the bridge at Sunning-on-Thames, making it only accessible to those on riverboats. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour, 9 o'clock here in London, for another check of your world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Tighe Enright. Now, it is one of the most prestigious literary prizes in the world, and the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize is now out. The award is given to a citizen of the Commonwealth as well as Zimbabwe, and yes, even Ireland, Tighe.
Oh, well, thanks for, thanks for the inclusion.
Perhaps have a shot next year.
Maybe so. I better get that book out of me. Well, on this year's shortlist, there are over two returning nominees, including Jim Craikes for Harvest and representing Ireland, Colm Tobin for The Testament of Mary. So what else can we expect from this year's list? And is there a particular favourite which has emerged? Well, a little earlier, Monocle's culture editor Rob Bound spoke to one of the judges of the Man Booker Prize, Natalie Haynes.
The chairman of your judges, Robert McFarlane,
yes,
said that he wanted novels this year.
Yeah.
So you've got six novels.
We have got six novel novels.
Phew.
Yeah, so good
she
we named them.
She sweat from her brows if she's written them.
So good we named them twice. yeah, no, I think it was one of those things where you don't really know each other until you all meet, the five of us. I knew Martha Carney because we'd worked together a lot for the BBC, and I really didn't know the others. I'd done a literary festival with Stuart Kelly once, Robert Douglas Fairhurst teaches at Oxford, so we hadn't coincided at all, and I didn't know Rob McFarlane at all. So it was only really when you kind of put us all in the same room, you realised that that was kind of what
we
were
all... Yes, right, and this is suddenly your job and this is what you've got to do.
Yeah, and you go, oh wait, this is what we all like. This is our point of convergence. What we like is people who are audacious. What we like is writers who are trying to do something brave and interesting. And I think it's fair to say that probably all of us prefer somebody who tries to do something ambitious, even if they fall slightly short, than somebody who presents a very good, sturdy, workmanlike piece of fiction. And so actually it was surprisingly easy to find novels.
We'll have a quick shifty through the shortlist then. We'll start at the top. I think we're doing it in sort of alphabetical
Let's
order.
Let's do an alphabetical
of the surname
order,
of the author.
That is fair,
fair, isn't it? We Need New Names by No Violet Bulawayo.
Yes.
The title of this almost sounds like a critique of former Booker years. We Need New Names.
Yeah, doesn't it? It's a heck of a piece of writing.
Yeah.
The narrator is a girl called Darling. She lives in a horrible shanty town in Zimbabwe, which is very ironically called Paradise. And she and her childhood friends play games and try to work out how come one of their 12-year-old friends is pregnant, and they dream of a better life elsewhere as the economy is sort of demolishing everything around them. And we read a bunch of books with child narrators this year, and not in an unfair way, it is reasonable to say that many of those children didn't sound like children. They sounded like men or women in their 30s or 40s pretending to be a child badly. No Violet Bulawayo has absolutely knocked this out of the park. Darling is an incredible voice. She will stick with you as she grows up and she does move to America. It's a migration story, I suppose. Her vocabulary changes and increases. Her outlook changes. It is a really terrific piece of ventriloquism.
Now we skip out of...
Go off out of order.
Yeah, because you're tired. I'm going to
mess you up. I don't know what could happen.
This is anarchy now.
Yeah, it is. Anything could happen.
Let's set lights to the studio.
All right.
And we were alluding to A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki.
Yes, again, two narrators.
Yeah.
One is Ruth, an author who lives in Canada. In case you think you've misheard me, it's written by Ruth Ozeki, an author who lives in Canada.
Having a bit of a Martin Amis moment here.
Well, do you know what? She mentions within the book, within a book, the idea of the Japanese eye novel, which I am prepared to go on record and say was not a phenomenon of which I was previously aware. Autobiographical novels written by, in this instance, Japanese women in the early 20th century. And that's one of the things that's mentioned here. So I guess this is a Canadian-Japanese, for Ozeki is Canadian-Japanese. It is a Canadian-Japanese eye novel. Ruth, the character, finds on the shore in Canada, for she lives right by the sea, the Pacific Ocean specifically, she finds a Hello Kitty lunchbox, and in that lunchbox is a diary. And the diary was written by a Japanese teenager called Nao, that is spelled N-A-O. But of course, I think you're meant to hear Now, N-O-W as well. And it's an extraordinary piece of writing. It's just an intensely kind of magical, zen piece of work. It marries Eastern and Western philosophies. Now's great-grandmother is a Zen Buddhist temple worker. And at the other end of the extreme is this sort of strange life she has in Tokyo. She grew up in California and then had to move to Tokyo, so she doesn't feel like she fits in. She's too big because she's had too much dairy as a child. And so it's a very intense story. Now is an unforgettable narrator. I know people say that lightly, but she is funny and clever and compelling and slangy. You know an awful lot more about Tokyo at the end of this book than you knew when you started out.
Well, the riot police have come and
shut us down.
They've shut us down.
Shut
we've
us
got
down.
It. We're going back to alphabetical
All
order.
All right, yeah, it seems
We're going to talk about Eleanor Catton's book, The Luminaries, and she sounds like a kind of a fairly bewitching novelist.
Yeah.
She's only 27. Right?
I know. You don't want to call her a sort of child genius because she's 27. And yet at the same time, you're like, you're how old? you've done what already?
This is her second book.
It's her second book. It's an epic, I think it would be fair to say. It comes in, at least my copy comes in, at 823 pages. It's the Gold Rush. It's New Zealand. It's the middle of the 19th century. And it is an extraordinary piece of work in which there are, at the beginning, a man named Walter Moody gets off a boat and walks into a lounge bar. And there are 12 people in there.
You've been doing too much time reading, not enough time
doesn't
drinking.
Doesn't it seem like it?
You've gotten very confused.
Yeah. he walks into the bar and there are 12 men in there and it becomes clear that they are all conspirators in some way or another. It's written with the luminaries are the stars themselves, and each of those 12 men matches up to a sign of the zodiac, and then there are a few other characters who match up to the planets, the sun and the moon.
Wow.
It's extremely clever.
It sounds like the kind of thing that had to have been plotted with a kind of star diagram.
At the time she must have spent doing it. It's like when I finished it the first time, I said it was basically like a Wilkie Collins novel set on the other side of the world. And I would stand by that, but in fairness to her, it's very much more complicated than that makes it sound. The work that must have gone into it makes me feel a little bit like applauding just sort of in principle.
Let's move on to Jim Crace's book, Harvest.
Yes.
This sounds like an interesting one. The time of talking now, he's been described as the favourite, whatever that can possibly mean.
They've pretty much picked it out of the air. I have no idea how they decide the odds,
exactly.
But that may be it. It is.
And Harvest is a sort of, what is it? Is it sort of like, is it in the tradition of sort of John Christopher and things like that? Is it a sort of slightly dystopian English bit of science fiction?
Yeah. Our chair, Rob McFarlane, has described it as a dark mummer play, and I'm not sure I can beat that, so I'll just steal it. In a year where the long list particularly and the short list still told tales of migration, We Need New Names is a migratory tale, obviously. I think it was surprising, perhaps, to find a book like Harvest, which is about the opposite of migration. It's about a small community, a very small community, tens of people, at no particular time or place in the English countryside, very specifically, and newcomers arrive and it destroys everything. And so this is all about not people who are on the move, but people who receive those who are on the move. It's about the host community of migrants and how that fear of change or acceptance of change can dictate everything which goes on. It's set through a week, so it has total unity of time and place. It's a really mesmerisingly sinister book. It's one of the very first we read.
It sounds like a sort of Lord of the Flies for grown-ups.
You know what? That's not at all bad as descriptions go. I think it was maybe the third or fourth book I read. So I read another 140 something after this. And it stayed in its sinister, compelling way right in the back of my mind until we got round to the point of discussing the long list. And it's really has parked up there. It's a very, very unnerving book.
And the last book is The Testament of Mary.
No, we missed out The Lowland.
Oh, no, we did. Sorry, The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri.
Yes.
Who's an American, US Indian writer.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I'm right to say she's already won a Pulitzer Prize. So she is no slouch, let's put it that way. The Lowland is a story which begins in Calcutta in the 20th century with the Naxalite revolution/rebellion. And there are two brothers who are quite politically engaged. They're students at the time that all this is going on. One of them goes away to Rhode Island to do his PhD and one of them stays behind. And I really don't want to give away more of the plot, so you'll have to wait and see.
Well, we will go on to the last one, The Testament of Mary,
yes,
by Colm Tóibín. This is kind of one of those things that's become an airport novel, strangely.
Yeah.
Not in that sense, but it's obviously been a hit.
Yes, it has to be quite a short
flight,
is that what you're thinking?
I'm thinking probably EasyJet to Ibiza.
Don't read it
on the way back, read it on the way there.
Maybe on the way there, yeah.
You might get a bit sad.
Yeah.
On the way back.
Yeah, it feels like we shouldn't need to know this story. It is obviously the story of the crucifixion and then the aftermath of the crucifixion of Jesus, as told by his mother. And it is so controlled, so beautifully written. I know when it was put on the long list, people said, are you sure this is a novel? It's only 104 pages long. I think it comes in at 30-something.
Did you do a short list, long list gag at that point?
Ah, we should have and missed the chance.
Yeah.
I guess all we could really kind of say was, aside from all the qualifications that render it a novel rather than a short story, that, you know, there are progressions of character, there's more than, and so on and so on. So all the boring kind of technical things that render it clearly a novel. Again, it just sticks in your memory so strongly and for so long. It feels like such an untold version of a story that everybody really already knows. And I said at the shortlist meeting, and I maintain it, that he has chosen his words like a poet chooses them, with that level of care. If everybody who had submitted one of their 151 books for this year's prize had chosen their words so carefully, we would have had many 100-page novels.
Yeah.
And as one of my fellow judges pointed out, slightly fewer novels might be the case. So yeah, it's a very careful, very beautiful, very precise, devastating piece of writing.
And that was Judge Natalie Haynes, a judge for the Man Booker Prize, speaking to our culture editor, Rob Bound.
And you're listening to Midori House. Up next, we talk to a man in the happiest country in the world.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:45 here in London and 9:45 in Copenhagen, where we head now to speak to Michael Booth. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Morning, how are you doing? Are you happy, I hope?
Well, I mean, I sit here feeling sheepish and inferior to what have to be your higher levels of happiness.
22nd in the world. Not very impressive for the UK.
I feel I'm not smiling.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, a few months ago, the OECD saw their happiness listing saw Denmark plummet, so the Danes were a bit upset about this. So
effectively, it's like a vicious circle of unhappiness.
Yes, exactly, but now they're back on top. According to Columbia University's Earth Institute's World Happiness Report 2013, which was published on Monday, Denmark is back on top, and the Danes are mighty relieved to be informed that they are actually once again the world's happiest people. I'll just give you the top five. Number one was Denmark, number two, Norway, number three, Switzerland, and at number four, the Netherlands, and down number five, Sweden, America at 17, UK, as I say, at 22, and the people plummeting, very unhappy these days, Italy, Greece, and no surprise, Egypt.
Well, as a Canadian, I think we're kind of up there, I think, in the, maybe the top 10, I'm hoping, so that
you
gives me...
So, yeah.
Yeah, that gives me a bit of happiness. But, Michael, you're a bit of an expert, though, when it comes to Danish happiness, and this happens to coincide with a new book which you're actually writing all about this.
Couldn't be better.
Really. Good timing.
I haven't paid, no money has changed hands.
This is why you're happy.
Now I see why he's picked this story.
Yeah, I'm
it's
extremely
a chance
happy,
to plug the book.
Exactly. I have a book coming out in Denmark in Danish. It's coming out in England in English in February. It's all about the whole Nordic miracle, the happiness phenomenon in Denmark. In Denmark, it's going to be called Der Er Et Lykkeligt Land. There is a happy country. And in English, it's going to be the almost nearly perfect people. So I've been really looking into this whole happiness phenomenon for the last 4 years. And it's quite interesting because Denmark, when you look at it superficially, they're amongst the unhealthiest people in Europe. They have the highest taxes in the world, the worst weather, I can vouch for that, highest cost of living in Europe, their economy's on the slide, they're up their eyeballs in Prozac and booze. So you wouldn't imagine that was a recipe for great happiness and success.
But they make great drama.
They make great unhappy dramas, that's true.
And it's the health down to all the bacon and pastries.
Precisely. And the smoking. They have a queen who has smoked very prominently for the last 40 years, so they think it's okay. She's still there in her 70s, so that kind of gives them permission to smoke their heads off.
So why is everyone so happy then? I can understand being happy with Prozac and booze, but other than that, why would you be so happy?
What about the comedowns, Phil?
You just keep taking it.
Well, they have some really key elements, actually, that are unique. They have extremely high levels of trust. They're the most trusting and perhaps trustworthy people in the world. They have incredible levels of social connectivity. They all belong to hockey clubs and chess clubs and trade unions and all that kind of thing. You're familiar with the concept of 6 degrees of separation. The Danes know each other by about 3 steps removed. They're all very interconnected. Not to overlook the fact that they're stinking rich compared to the rest of the world. They're in the world's top 10, I believe, per capita income. What else? It's a safe country. It has political stability. There's general high levels of freedom, autonomy in the workplace. And talking about work, they're extremely lazy. They don't work. They work fewer hours than most of the rest of Europe. So
when people say, just the Greeks.
No. The Danes work. The Greeks work much, much more. Many more hours per week than the Danes. Yeah. So when people say, why are the Danes happy? I say, of course they're happy. They don't work.
Well, amid all this happiness, there seems to be a rush towards right-wing politics. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I don't know how do we quantify that. But yes, the notorious right-wing Dansk Folkeparti, the Danish People's Party, is rather, as their peers in Norway have shown us this week, on the rise. They're currently shot up 5 points in the opinion polls. They're very close to being the second biggest party in Denmark. And this, somehow they didn't get my message last year when they chose a new leader who I painted and described as extremely boring and a vote loser. He's actually turned the fortunes of the party around and somehow managed to claw his way back up the polls.
I might have to cancel my order for your book, Michael, if...
yeah, you shouldn't trust a word I say.
But this potentially could be a very important step in the history and the politics of Denmark, because if there is this perhaps shift to the right-wing elements of politics, it could potentially open up a new schism between the more centrist and more liberal parts of the country, no?
Well, we've seen them. They had a great amount of power. They were essentially the power brokers in the government for the first 10 years of this century, and that did great damage to Denmark. You'll remember the Mohammed cartoon crisis. They were all part of an element of stoking the flames behind that. They also unilaterally tried to close down the barriers to Denmark, renege on the Schengen Agreement. So they've done great damage through having power in Denmark in the past to Denmark's international reputation, and the fear is they'll do it again. What's interesting is their success, I think, recently isn't on the Islamophobic anti-immigrant pitch. They're really gunning for the old social democrat voters, the public sector workers, the pensioners, and they're one of the few parties that are actually urging greater public spending, greater public sector, greater welfare spending, which is very much against the tide in Denmark. But that's what's winning them the votes.
Turning to the Danish economy now, Michael, and great hopes for a new export? How can it be a new export? Danish design is being seen as a export in itself.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the fact that Danes don't work terribly much, this has been reflected in problems with their competitiveness, global competitiveness. They dropped from third in the world on the UN's, the World Economic Forum's list to about 15th. So there's a new export drive. They're trying to get the rest of the world to buy their products. And among those products of interest to Monocle listeners is the furniture of Fritz Hansen, who make classic Danish items from designers such as Arne Jacobsen, Hans J. Wegner, and Paul Kjærholm. It seems a bit of a shame that Denmark is looking to these 1950s, 60s design to pull them out of an export hole. But there you go.
Is it enough?
No,
one designer?
No. But they also have some pretty big names in this new export drive. Arla, the dairy, Carlsberg, Lego, of course, Maersk. So they're not doing too badly, but... So they're not just relying on swan and egg chairs.
And don't forget Danish dramas, TV dramas, of course, which is one of their biggest and most successful.
And Danish butter and bacon. And pastries. Michael Booth, Monocle's man in Copenhagen, thank you very much for that. And this is Midori House with me, Tadhg Enright, and Phil Han. Time now to review this morning's Brazilian front pages. Joining us now in the studio is Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. What have you got for us, Fernando?
Hello, good morning.
How are you?
Very, very good.
Brazil's a pretty happy place, is it?
I think so. I was actually commenting, I'm not sure if I agree with this list. You know, I've been to Denmark. I mean, they're lovely people, but they don't strike me as the happiest. I don't know.
That's
just my personal view. Sorry.
Maybe it's because like the language, which, you know, having suddenly gotten into that political drama Borgen is really quite ugly, I have to say.
Yeah, it's quite you know,
yeah,
like, I don't know how to explain
it's guttural,
that.
But, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Brazil and perhaps some of the stories they're making in the front pages this morning.
I'm going to start with a not very happy story from Folha de São Paulo. You know, the case of that the US spied Brazil, including its main companies such as Petrobras, which was revealed yesterday, is still causing quite a lot of controversy in the country, especially because, and I think it could be quite damaging for the US-Brazil relations, because Dilma is going in October to the US for a state visit. And there might even some rumors that she might not go, actually. But then there's a very interesting column, opinion piece on today's Folha de São Paulo by Julia Zweig. She's saying that Dilma should not cancel her state visit, you know, because then that would be like a sign that Brazil can deal with diplomatic tensions, even though it would be good for Dilma's popularity if she decided not to go, you know, because then, you know, people in Brazil are quite angry, say, how could they do that?
So it's a bit of a balance that Dilma needs to strike with the domestic politics of this decision, plus, of course, the long-term diplomatic relationships with the U.S., of course, which is one of their most important partners.
Exactly. And if I were her, I would definitely go there and have, like, I mean, it's a state visit. I think it's been like more than 10 years that Brazil doesn't have a state visit to the U.S. as
but
well.
But how's the dynamic, the relationship change between Brazil and the United States, with Brazil climbing up the global league of not just economic importance, but diplomatic importance as well? I mean, they're not quite the underdog that they used to be to the United States.
Yeah, I always have the feeling that, you know, Brazil and US, they should have like kind of a more, I don't know if I can say that, warm relationship, because they don't, you know, and they're, I mean, the two biggest countries in the Americas, you know, and I think the relationship could improve even more. But, you know, this fact that they've been spying on us doesn't really help.
Doesn't help
at all.
And Fernando, you were just in the United States. You were just in New York last week, actually.
Exactly, my first time
in
New York.
And we spoke about this yesterday. You were noticing a bit of the ties between Brazil and the Americans seem to be quite strong.
Exactly. You know, as I said, you know, the New York Fashion Week is happening and there's some Brazilian designers there. And there's quite a big Brazilian community in New York as well. There's a lot of Brazilian restaurants. So, I mean, there is a connection. You know, a lot of Brazilians still want to go there. And Americans are one of the biggest groups of tourists who go to Brazil. So, and yeah, I hope we improve our relationship somehow.
You've got some sports to talk to us about. Formula One. God, I hate that sport.
You hate that sport?
It's putting it mildly.
It is a bit boring.
It's like standing at a motorway flyover.
Well, but I have to say, when Ayrton Senna was racing, I used to love Formula One.
Okay.
I used to watch every single... I mean, I was a kid then, but...
Is it more to do with him, though, than the cars whizzing around a track?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. But that's an interesting story, because Formula One is hugely popular in Brazil. I think, to be honest, after football is our main sport.
Well, you've got a lot of big drivers, haven't you? Mm.
Exactly. Probably not anymore, actually.
Oh, that's the story you're talking about,
isn't it? That's
the
story, exactly. Because Felipe Massa, you know, he's in Ferrari now, but then it's just been announced that he's not going to be... racing for Ferrari next year. And it's going to be a problem, because Brazil might not have any pilot in next season for Formula One. And that's going to be the first time we're not going to have a pilot since 1969. And I think it's quite weird. I think they might have to find a Brazilian driver, because it's such a big market for them.
Well, as if to underline just how ignorant I am about Formula One, I had no idea that you call the drivers pilots.
We were talking about an airline.
Oh.
Yeah. But yeah. Well, let's quickly, though, Fernando, move on to something that maybe we can all relate to a bit more. Food trucks?
Food trucks.
We
can definitely relate
to
that. Yeah, you know this trend in major European cities to have this kind of boutique food trucks, you know, selling from hot dogs to, I don't know, burritos or whatever. So basically, there was a law that was passed yesterday in São Paulo approving those food trucks in the main avenues of the city, because before this was not regulated. But now, especially, I mean, a lot of Brazilian chefs ask the government to do that. So, I mean, you can maybe try some Brazilian snacks, like a gourmet ones, like a coxinha, pão de queijo, which it's like a little cheese pastry that we have, and you put some warm butter. It's just amazing.
So you don't have to try too hard to convince me of that.
Oh, God,
you know, pastry, warm butter, this time of the morning.
Prozac, booze, come on. I'll try to make some and bring it next time.
Fantastic. Well, with that, I'll be back every morning if given the chance. But that's all we have time for today, unfortunately. Thank you very much to our producer, Alan John, our researcher. Joining us right here, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Falco. Our studio manager today was Bill Luthi.
Up next after the news is The Menu with Marcus Ippi to get us even more hungry. Myself and Chloe Potter will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Tig Enright.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.